Okay. In investigating life, trying to find some common denominator of knowledge, behavior, and activity, it was necessary to screen quite a few principles. Been a lot of things advanced the past few thousand years concerning what life was doing. Matter of fact, some pretty wild ones have been put forward. None of them, however, were workable to the degree that an engineer requires workability. You see, possibly for the first time, the principles of engineering were well enough known in a school and in a society to actually be applied to the field of the mind. A rare circumstance existed there. Man has been attacking, conquering the physical universe. He hasn't been spending much time trying to recover all the data he could from any other level. If there is any other level, he was asking himself, man was. Even if there is one, we'll pay attention to it, sure. We'll put it in good hands for safekeeping, and we'll develop physics and chemistry, gunpowder, and other useful items, such as Lee Enfield rifles. And the data that had been developed on forward from the days of Francis Bacon about science had all this while been quietly and unannouncedly been building up data about thought. They didn't realize that. Been a lot of data built up. How does one think logically? Well, Aristotle could sit back there and do a pretty good job in the days of the ancient Greeks saying, logic is. And then go off and wander through the hills and far away and be very proud of himself, and it'd be very beautifully written. Plato could come along and do a good job on it. Lucretius. People all along the line. But anything went because their logic did not have to be applied to the physical universe. And the physical universe has a very unhappy method of suddenly turning around and kicking you in the teeth if you don't think right about it. An engineer goes out and he starts to build a bridge. And here's a river. And he wants to build a bridge and run a train across it. And just beyond that chasm is a hill. And the train's going to have to go around, go over, or go through that hill. Well, it doesn't do the engineer any good to say, well, let me see. According to the ancient Greeks, such and such and so and so. So therefore, no river could possibly exist at this point, so naturally a bridge is necessary. Come up with this happy solution, he starts out his train, and it goes roaring along, and crash. That'd be the end of that. Physical universe puts an awfully hard test on thought and logic. And if he even built the bridge but said the mountain wasn't in existence, the train would run into the mountain. This test and trial by violence, you might say, that the physical universe puts up against an engineer permits no compromises. One can't go shilly-shallying around and saying, well, let me see, if I cut the prefrontal lobes out of this human being, why, there was a man in Germany, and this fellow in Germany was working at a forge. He was an idiot, and he was working at a forge, and the forge exploded, and it blew a crowbar in one temple and out the other temple, and he lived. So therefore, it's possible to cut the prefrontal lobes out of a man. I think I will. So he does, and he knows nothing's going to happen anyhow because nothing can be done about it anyway. And by the way, the story I just gave you is the fundamental impetus on the prefrontal lobotomy. I've read the original releases on it, and it does not claim that the man was anything now but an idiot. It didn't change his mental state. All it announces is the fact that a crowbar could drive through the prefrontal lobe, so therefore it's legitimate to operate on it. That's not logic. The psychiatrist would have gotten nothing in return if he failed, because there is no penalty for this type of failure. Everybody says crazy people are crazy, and they're crazy. There's nothing can be done about it anyway. So it doesn't matter what you do to their brains. They're hopeless anyway. In other words, they weren't up against the physical universe. They were up against a bunch of stuff that they thought might or might not be logic. So it was perfectly all right to fail. Well, it isn't all right to fail to an engineer, so therefore engineering logic has become pretty tight stuff. It says, in so many words, you do so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and you get this result. And by George, if you omit doing this and yet do this and this, you won't get that result. But if you do those things, you get that result. And you don't get it once in a while. You don't get it every 1,000 years. You don't get it 50% of the time, but you get it every time. If you do so-and-so and so-and-so, you get this. Uncompromising. Terrifically rigid discipline. An engineer reads through the maundering of people about human thought, and he's struck immediately with a very strange thing. Nobody thought it was necessary to get a common denominator of what behavior was. Why were men behaving that way? No, nobody thought it was necessary to get a common denominator. Now, that's one of the first things that one must have if one is going to erect a pyramid of logic. He's got to have a common denominator. There's got to be a datum that is big enough and embracive enough to embrace all the other data. And unless he can find such a datum, he isn't going to embrace anything. So his search would naturally be for the lowest common denominator he could find in the terms of behavior. What is man trying to do here on earth? Now, if you go at it this wise and you say, what's he trying to do? Is he trying to shoe horses? Is he trying to be important? That's a pretty good one, be important. Is he trying to be silly, as in government? Or anything like this? What is it? What's the common denominator of behavior? Well, you know, I can tell you by experience that you can chew around on this for years without getting any answer. Darwin came along and he talked about the survival of the fittest. It really doesn't make too much sense, the survival of the fittest. When you start to look over the overall picture of the whole theory of evolution, you find out it's got holes in it. What's wrong with it, though, is his theory of natural selection. An engineering approach to the theory of evolution immediately demonstrates to you that the chances against the happy and fortuitous developments of the organism, as postulated in the theory of natural selection, are utterly impossible. I mean, they're 10 to the 21st binary digits, 10 to the 21st binary digits, 10 to the 21st binary digits, impossible. I mean, the odds against the accidental formation of life, the odds against its developing any form, I don't care how many billions of years you postulate or anything else, you just start to add it up in actuarial mathematics, and you find yourself up against the dead end of impossibility. Yes, it might have gotten up to that terrific complexity called the monocell. And that's a terrifically complex thing. That has a nervous system, everything. It's a mechanism which takes sunlight and chemicals and develops motion and so forth from it. Warmth. And it's a converter. Very complex. An engineer today trying to build a monocell operating machinery, even though he built a model that high, would be unable to do it with our modern technology. He wouldn't even come close to it. It's that complex. And this all happened by accident out of mud, huh? Then the fortuitous accident with which several monocells got together and formed an organism. And the fortuitous accident by which a vertebrae was finally formed and lungs and finally man. I mean, every time you get one of these new extra steps, You add in the factors against its happening, and you say, well, let's allow that it took a billion years for this thing to get from an organism without a spine to an organism with part of a spine. Let's allow a billion years. Now let's figure out how many accidents had to happen in that period and what the odds were against. We find out they're billions to one. Billions and billions and billions and billions to one. Too many other things could have happened. So this theory was not too sound. Too much chance. Obviously, life didn't quite approximate. Not quite approximate the whole of the physical universe. There's some difference between life and the physical universe. And all of a sudden we realized that science and the engineer himself had gone completely slap-happy from the days of Newton. And they said, oh, look, the law of interaction, the law of acceleration, the law of inertia. Here we've got three beautiful laws. Let's apply them to human behavior, and that's it, boys. Now it's all solved, and we go off and do something else. And they never bothered to look at the result. The result was psychology. Anyway. Actually, an understanding of humanity and behavior was attempted after Newton's developed laws. Now, however, Newton was dealing with electricity, various energies, matter, space, time. And you look this over and it fails when it's applied to human behavior. There's something different about life. There's something about life that is native to no other part of the physical universe. And it is so thoroughly unnative that one all of a sudden finds that he can best think about it by considering life to be something else than part of the physical universe. Let's not parallel it anymore to electricity. Let's look at it for its own behavior level. Let's look at it as an energy suddenly laid down from Mars or someplace, and let's just take a look at it and consider it that way and find out what it really does do. And in that way, some answer can be derived. What's life trying to do? It's trying to survive. How does it survive? The conquest of the physical universe. Now, that's very, very briefly stated. It requires a tremendous amount of expansion. But that's actually the basic fundamental. What is life trying to do? It's trying to survive. How is it surviving? What method does it have of surviving? Its method of survival is a conquest of the physical universe. We don't even claim this is true. We don't even claim that this is all that life is doing. Maybe in some other universe and in some other ways, life is doing something else too. But certainly, using this postulate, we can start making headway and making it swiftly. What are we trying to do? We're trying to survive. What's survival? What's the penalty of not surviving? It's as though at some point back on the track somewhere, somebody said to this energy, survive. And completely unlike the clerk mentioned by Elbert, the energy didn't turn around and say, how? Or anything. It just went ahead and survived. And all of its combinations of survival operating into the physical universe and out of it again, apparently, along that one line of action. That is a common denominator, which happens to satisfy practically everything that's known about man. I have been looking at it now off and on for about 13 years, and I haven't found anything that didn't fall into its category. Survive or succumb. This, by the way, and I did not realize this until relatively short time ago, this, by the way, does not violate any of the principles of human soul. It isn't necessary, then, to go what is commonly called completely materialistic in order to look over the survival level. It goes to this degree. Supposing one, they say the human soul departs. What do they say the human soul does? They say it has infinite survival. It lives forever. Well, life everlasting. That's survival. That is the ultimate of survival. That's survival plus. So we're not even in violation with this in the field of religious tenets. Now, perhaps we are using survival, but perhaps the word survival is not as completely embracing of what we are talking about as it might be. Perhaps other people have a different concept of this word survival, so we better say what we conceive it to mean. Survival is not a matter of bare necessity. Bare necessity does not survive. I'll show you that rather rapidly. Farmer goes out here. Some fellow foolish enough to be a farmer. Starts shooting dice with the universe at large, planting his corn and his wheat. Government on one side and the devil on the other. And he starts raising himself wheat. He says, I'm going to need 6 bushels of wheat for each month of the ensuing year. Now, this fellow, we're dealing with bare necessity. He says, I'm going to need just that many bushels of wheat, and I can get by and feed my family and my stock all right with the other things that are around. And so he plants that thing. Grasshoppers took that one. His ineptitude in planting wheat took that one. This was Kansas, so the hail took that one. And he'd forgotten that wheat had to be processed in order to make flour, and the miller took that one. And he was living in the United States, so he had to pay an income tax, and the government took those. He starved to death. That was the end of him. Because he postulates survival on bare necessity. And any time an individual does that, he's in bad shape. Survival, the barest survival, has to be on such a tremendous abundance that one is rather staggered at when he realizes that in a lifetime, the average individual makes about $150,000, $200,000. He's paid that much. He is living with margins and factors of safety all around him, which are anywhere from 5 to 20 times as much as he needs. If he doesn't, the give and take will absorb one of those fives or one of those tens, and all of a sudden he's dead on that point. Life is not exactly a safe venture. I think in the field of insurance, they make a bit of a gamble out of whether or not people survive or not. They figure it all out, and they look this person over, and they sell him some insurance. Now, here we have survival in abundance. Survival in abundance will get somebody through. It'll get a group through. This group has to operate, however, on the engineering principle of factor of safety. An engineer who builds a bridge to stand 100 tons, when 100 tons is going to be the common load of that bridge, has violated a fundamental of abundance. And the bridge will wear a little bit, sag a little bit, somebody was a little dishonest with his material, and gone will go the bridge. So he builds it to hold 500 tons, because he knows its normal load will be 100 tons. Or sometimes they'll build factors of safeties. They do this in England. England wants to be known as a staunch country. And over there in England, they will build 20, 25 factors of safety into something. An American goes over there and tries to lighten up their railroad carriages so their trains will go somewhat faster than 10 miles an hour. And they'll say, I say, old boy, our reputation for solidity is at stake. And then they develop socialism. Anyway, when you have violated a factor of safety in living, you have violated a primary concept of survival.
and that in order to survive any length of time, an individual has to have a lot of wherewithal. Furthermore, he has to survive through and with many things in order to guarantee his survival. Otherwise, he'll succumb. Now, here's a graph, you might say, of this, by the way, that I'm drawing you now is the basic of this chart of human evaluation. This is the raw chart. Here we have zero, death. This chart is plotted this way, time, and plotted this way, its height of survival. That's zero, one, two, three, and four. These are levels of existence. Here is your survival potential of immortality, way up there. Now, if we draw a vector anywhere here, let's draw a vector here for one organism, to this point, we find out its potential of survival measured in time is not as good as an organism which is there on the tongue scale. In other words, we can measure this arrow as a vector, and we can predict the length of time that way that the individual will survive.
Please note, at this point there was a break in the original master recording. This tape now resumes as did the original master recording.
But of course, on this theory of abundance, if he were up here all the time, by his theory of survival must be pretty good, and he's going to live quite a while. If he's down here, pretty bad. His distance to death, so on. So that this one will go off about like that. There's death. This one, you might say, will ride off like about that. This will go on here quite a bit. And this one will go on here without much diminishing. How long will a person live? This is a chart. Where a person appears on that chart will actually predict his longevity. You take his age as a factor and you draw about where he is on this potential of survival, measured by many things, and you can find out about where this fellow's going to die. You get him down below 20, and it gets steep. It gets pretty steep, because down below 20, survival is so poor, the abundance is so slight, that the individual is heading toward succumb as his goal. He's not heading anymore toward survival. He's heading toward succumb. Above this point, he's heading toward survival. In other words, he has so little chance here to survive that he will actually accelerate his own demise rapidly. And in doing so, will accelerate the demise of those people in his vicinity. Here is an individual who is just barely over the line. If that individual happens to meet up with this individual, the combination there isn't strong enough to do anything, and you get a steep line on into death. But if you have a fellow up here, and he meets one of these fellows, this fellow will probably just go on and die, and that fellow will stay up there. When you add in all of these factors, it doesn't matter how many factors you add in here, or how many things you try to figure out on this line, nevertheless, it comes up against this chart as a conclusion. Now, when we're talking about death, of course, we're just talking about the organism, the death of the organism. The physical universe has energy, which is imperishable. It doesn't matter how many atoms you change into how many electrons, not even the A-bomb has controverted the conservation of energy. Conservation of energy is still very much with us. Strangely enough, the force of life evidently follows this same rule of conservation of energy. And there is, by the way, far more evidence in existence now in Dianetics as to the immortality of the force of life, regardless of the mortality of the organism, than there is against an immortality. A long time ago, science and religion did a wild severance. Somebody tried to change a few doctrines down in Rome, and some scientist, and they burned him, and scientists got mad at religion. And religion decided that science was very wrong for being mad. They did a little bit of a parting of the company. It's very strange to now, without wanting to, since I haven't any great personal interest in this field, all of a sudden watching the inevitable realignment. People in the foundation, by the way, for the last year have been going just a little bit mad on the subject of my daring to say anything about what has been discovered about the human soul and the other cycle of existence and so on. We keep running into this evidence. We can put our hands on it. And we look at it, and everybody says, it's too incredible. Shut up. Don't tell people about this. It'll validate Dianetics. Well, I don't believe that way. I say, well, look, here's some evidence. I can't evaluate it all, but it certainly seems to mean that life has a certain level of immortality, but the organism doesn't. And also, there seems to be here some data in favor of the survival of the personal identity. And a long time ago, they were looking for this as positive proof when skeptics would come along. Gee, supposing you could show it to everybody in an equation, they'd say, that is it. And we would have an immortality. People in the foundation have been saying, shh, be quiet. Don't talk about this. It's very bad. Actually, Dianetics is very calmly, most of the time, rather materialistic about all these things. Talks about pain. You knock out pain, and a guy gets more things, and he does more, and he has more energy, and he conquers more of the physical universe, so on. Very materialistic line. Lying right back here and going along quietly is a beautiful thread of mysticism, which when you're dealing with a science, you know, It's not like psychology. You don't call into existence or blow out of existence random facts which show up. Just because something doesn't fit with your frame of reference, you say don't say it doesn't exist, because it'll come back up and slap you in the face and upset all of your calculations if you're really working with some power. So you can't ignore this thing back here. And here is the energy of life. It evidently is a survival energy, but it comes into an organism. It forms up with the material universe. Here's life energy, and here's the material universe, and they go, bing, and you've got an organism. Organism grows, becomes highly mobile, mature, so on, creates another organism, goes on living itself. So you get a cycle of species here. You get cycle of generations. Here's this one starting up, and that's one generation that goes along and dies, and another one branches out here, and it goes along and off, and you've got your succeeding generations. You even got life forms, like the dinosaur, chickens, things like that. A whole species will start up, and die off, and you get a bigger cycle in existence. Life as an energy is very definitely operating behind this. This tone scale is a representation of the fact that a life form has as good a chance of surviving as it has been able to better the suppressors in its environment. In other words, it's got to have been better in overcoming its environment than the environment was in overcoming it. As the environment kicks back on the organism too hard, you get this. When it doesn't kick back terribly hard, you get this and less and less. And if it hasn't kicked back at all, you've got that. In other words, you've got the organism has overcome the environment. We have two factors involved here. How is one of these organisms surviving? How is it surviving? Well, somebody who thinks along with a lot of strange very materialistic philosophies, that an individual is not completely interdependent with the rest of the universe has certainly not done very much thinking about it. The individual who says, I can live alone, it's very interesting. He can't live without the lichen and the moss. They create soil so that vegetables can grow. Now, he can't live without a lot of odds and ends. Trees to make firewood, life form. He has to be interdependent with this life form. Most important, he's interdependent with the physical universe, too, because he'd sure play the devil surviving as a human organism if he didn't have an earth to walk on. And as far as the physical universe of space and time is concerned, the earth would certainly look awful silly if it didn't have any space and time to exist in. So the individual lives because of cooperation. He lives because of cooperation with other individuals, life forms, the physical universe. This is life. He can only live if he is in cooperation with these things. Now, that's very plain, it's very elementary. But it's a very funny thing that as an individual drops back down this tone scale, he goes further and further out of cooperation with other life forms, because other life forms have suppressed him, and he begins to conceive their enemies. And the second he begins to conceive that he has an enemy in another life form, his suppressor gets stronger, he has less chance of surviving. Something happens there which suppresses his chance of survival. The more trouble he runs into, the more conflict he gets into, the more physical pain he suffers in his conquest of the universe, the less he is able to ally himself with the rest of the universe, and the less he will ally himself with the rest of the universe. And it's a sort of a hideous spiral. Here's an example. Little boy goes out. He's everybody's friend. He runs down the street and he falls, trips, falls, hits his head on the curb. Boom! The curb is now non-survival. Well, he goes a little bit further through life and he meets another little boy, and they have an argument about something or other, which grows out of something strange, and all of a sudden, well, it probably grows out of him falling on the curb. And you get, boom, he has a fight with this other little boy, so he's just that much estranged from this other little boy. Now he's estranged from the curb, he's estranged from this other little boy a little bit. So he goes out in the woods, and he's walking through the woods, and the wind is blowing, and boom, a limb falls and hits him on the back of the neck and hurts him. And so there he's just a little bit much, just that much out of cooperation and association with limbs and trees and the wind. And so it goes. And the more he has to conceive danger, this isn't experience, this is physical pain. The more physical pain he receives from his environment, the less chance of survival he himself has as an organism. It goes in direct ratio. The dynamics mean simply how many forms of survival are there? How does an individual survive? Well, you can work this whole thing out rather by playing dog leg holes. You can work this thing out that the individual survives solely because of himself and cooperates only because of selfishness. But you can also work it out that he survives only for future generations and prove it all very beautifully that way. You can work it out, as they have in Russia, that the individual survives solely for the state and is only part of an ant society, a collectivist. And so it goes, one right after the other. You can take these ways he survives and you can make each one it. When you put it to the test, you find out that you need all of them, all of the dynamics. Now, the number of dynamics which are in existence
are rather counted up at this time,
merely add up the number of fields or entities a man has to be in cooperation with
in order to get along.
There's the first dynamic.
Call that self. Man has to live as himself. In other words, he has to survive as self.
Two,
he has to survive through future generations. Here we have children. But the act of sex produces children, so you get really two twos, 2A, 2B. So you have
children,
and you have sex as a part of the same urge. The reason for sex is children, Freud and people in Hollywood to the contrary. Now,
three
is the dynamic of groups. An individual survives
for the group.
The third dynamic. He can survive almost wholly for the group, as a matter of fact. The reason he's alive is for the group. The group, the family group, by the way, goes between these two. I mean, it's part of group and it's part of sex, children. But that's a specialized group. The individual can survive through the survival of the group. You know, Roger Young, and he gives up his life for a company. He just crossed out number one, and he goes on living in three. Of course, that's highly specious stuff, being part of an army group, but nevertheless, people will do it. Now,
number four
is survival through man as a species. Even if you had an American and Russian, and even if they were army officers, even then, highly antagonistic toward each other, if one of Orson Welles' men from Mars suddenly showed up, I'm afraid you'd find the North Koreans and the South Koreans and the UN and the Russians and the communists all joining hands to shoot the devil out of that foreign species if it were considered to be a menace to man. Man actually works on the fourth dynamic. War is a breakdown on the fourth dynamic.
Because an individual will survive as man. Now, fifth is life.
Fifth dynamic, an individual survives to make life survive. In other words, he's interested in the survival of life. He raises canary birds, he raises cats, Pekingese, he raises trees, he'll raise ornamental shrubs, all sorts of things that have nothing to do directly with his survival, apparently. But they are directly concerned with his survival, because his survival lies in everything. Now, your sixth dynamic is the physical universe. The physical universe is, of course, is matter, energy, space, and time. By the way, we call that, just composite those words and you get messed in Dianetics. Matter, energy, space, and time, physical universe. A man doesn't want to see the physical universe disappear. I know they had a beautiful cartoon down at Caltech a few years ago. A scientist with a terrifically ecstatic look on his face is standing up in front of a group of engineers, and he's saying, "Gentlemen, I have here the last word, the ne plus ultra of all scientific endeavor and achievement. In this small capsule, I have enough explosive to destroy the entire universe." Actually, they want the physical universe to survive.
Then we have the seventh dynamic, which is the survival as life energy,
an urge toward the survival of life energy. Just as such, we get terrifically interested when we think of life energy as it is, as it survives, what it might combine with, and so forth. And then we put another one down here. Let's put down the Creator. Supreme Being. One of the people in the class, because seven is an interesting number mathematically, but the Supreme Being, written as eight, laying over on his side, and you have infinity. This would be all that lies behind and all that created all the rest. Now, here are your various dynamics. These might be said to be a bundle. And when you draw this tone scale, and you draw one vector that represents one person, you're actually drawing eight vectors. You're drawing eight lines. Because that individual's trying to survive one way or the other on all these dynamics at once. And actually, no solution is an optimum solution unless it takes into account all the dynamics influenced by it and gives each one its optimum solution. That sounds very complicated, but it means if you and Bill are in business together and you try to do a solution that gives you all the benefit and doesn't give Bill any, you'll find out that it will not work out. It's a fundamental in these dynamics that every time you get a solution where the other dynamics aren't taken into account, where their interests aren't taken into account, you get a general failure. Now, it's interesting that here are your eight dynamics, and you mark up this fellow on the tone scale, and you say his vector goes up to two. This individual will take into account less and less of the dynamics. In other words, they're all foreshortened, but his view into the more distant dynamics or the more distant things is much less. He becomes unsafe to that degree that he will not take into account the right to survival of other life forms and the physical universe around him. In other words, he cuts down then the survival of other things when he's that low on the tone scale. But as he drifts away from four down, he pays less and less attention to these other dynamics. And oddly enough, he stops paying attention to dynamic one, too. He won't pay attention to dynamic one. Suicides. Anybody from two down is on his way out. And you get somebody at 1.5, he'll all of a sudden, one fine day, he fails to destroy something that he considers an enemy, and he'll kill himself instead. Boom, boom. You get somebody down to 0.5, they're almost lead pipe cinches and eventual suicide one way or the other. Now, an optimum solution of life, then, is taking into account the maximum survival for everything concerned in the problem. This does not mean that one cannot destroy. It so happens that if we didn't have destruction as one of the operating methods of existence, we'd be in pretty bad shape. Do you realize that every fern tree that was growing back there in the earliest ages would still be growing? And this would be in addition to every tree that had grown since. And we would have live growing trees on the face of the earth until we'd probably be walking about 800 feet above the soil. Death, destruction, has to come in there and clear the way for advances and improvements. And destruction, when used in that way, is very legitimate. For instance, you can't build an apartment house without knocking down the tenement that stood there before. Now somebody comes along and say, oh, that's very bad. You're destroying something. You're destroying an old landmark. We're trying to put up an apartment house here, lady. Yeah, but that's a very old landmark. Lady, that thing is about ready to fall into the street. Oh, it's very bad to destroy things. Well, that's pretty aberrated, because if you didn't destroy something once in a while, just think what would happen, for instance, if you'd never lost and destroyed any of the papers. Supposing every piece of paper that had ever been given you in your lifetime was still in your possession. And then you had to move. And
It was very bad to destroy things, so you kept on lugging all these things around with you. You see how ridiculous it gets. But there's an actual equation involved in this. One must not destroy beyond the necessity in construction, required in construction. If one starts to destroy beyond the necessity required in constructions, one gets into pretty bad shape very hurriedly. One gets into the shape Nazi Germany's in today. Boom! They destroy everything. They say, now Austria, now Czechoslovakia, now let's knock apart Stalingrad. Sure, they knocked apart Stalingrad. Great. Stalingrad's an awful mess. So is Germany. You know, there's that old truism, do not send a fine for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Nothing is truer. People start looking at this and they get superstitions about it. They say, well, I don't dare harm anybody else because then I would be harmed someplace or other. Not necessarily true. But on the overall equation of life and existence, the willful destruction of something can upset the survival of the other entities in its vicinity. And it can upset and overbalance things to a point where, well, we don't have any more passenger pigeons and so forth. One didn't stop and think back there 100 years ago that one of these fine days, there wouldn't be any. Obviously, there were all kinds of them all over the sky. So man, by the way, has had to go into a tremendous game conservation program in order to restore the wildlife, which his grandpa wiped out. So man will do this quite instinctively. But the degree to which he does it and the degree to which he will support the other factors, the other dynamics around him, the other entities around him, the degree in which five, for instance, active in the individual, is very apparent the second that you begin to match this person up on the tone scale. You take somebody down below 2.0 and you say, will this person support game conservation? No. He's on his way out. Why shouldn't the game be on the way out too? The whole bunch has moved down. And as an organism, he'll just hasten his way out to the exit. From two down on this tone scale, a person actually actively seeks death. And he'll bring death in varying degrees and in very specific ways on very specific things. But all I'm trying to give you here is just some concept of what the dynamics of existence are. This has been found to be workable. I'm not giving it to you because it is true. Giving it to you because it has a workability. An engineer never asks for anything but a workability. He has been bludgeoned down in his conquest of the physical universe to a point where he knows darn well that 50 years from now, that postulate, which he is so fond, which he considers so ultimate, which he considers so beautiful, will probably be moved back a step into a greater simplicity. He recognizes this. If he doesn't, he is a fool. Because every time one of these postulates set up, found to be workable, life can become better, man can better control his environment, but each one of them, you just got your foot in the door just a little bit further. And you hang on as long as you can till somebody else comes along and puts his foot in the door and takes the ball. That's all in the operation of cooperation. Therefore, when we look over the dynamics of existence, we find out that man is surviving, that he has to survive in abundance in order to survive at all. What does honesty have to do with it? Well, obviously, honesty is merely a cooperation, you might say, or a sympathy with other organisms. One would not be dishonest unless he wished to seek advantage for himself or his group at the expense of some other self or group. That's dishonesty.
is seeking an illegitimate advantage. You can actually give it a definition. And it's illegitimate just because it violates somebody's survival too much. So the person who is honest, he happens to survive better. Old Ben Franklin advanced that one on the stage. It almost startled the merchant princes of America out of their nightcaps. That was one of the most revolutionary things that happened back there before the revolution. Ben Franklin was writing Poor Richard's Almanac, and one day he came up with this thing. He started to beat the drum and said, honesty is the best policy. And everybody says, what? This was in Philadelphia. I can't understand it. And as a matter of fact, he had a lot of rows about it. I think that was actually where he developed his skill in argument. He was trying to advance the strange policy that the best policy was an honest one. It was revolutionary in its day. Seems rather ordinary here in American business. We know that a business which doesn't treat its customers or even its competitors with some degree of honesty is practically doomed. But back in the day when this was not the style, a fellow was doomed if he did. So, the more honest the individual is about his goals, the more honest a group is, it just works out that he survives better, that's all. His group survives better, and life as a whole is better. As far as ideals are concerned, although we have the ultimate goal of infinite survival, there are many sub-goals. The most interesting of these sub-goals to an individual is that goal which seems to best promote his own survival. If he examines the thing carefully, if he examines this goal he's trying to attain carefully, he will see where he's advancing. As a matter of fact, his enthusiasm for that goal is in direct ratio to the amount of survival which it holds forth to him. This gets up into ideals. If you don't have any ideals mixed up in these dreams, if you don't keep up high standards along these lines, the chances of reaching these goals go pretty bad off. Let's take the young fellow who wants to be a musician. He has great ideals about being a musician. He wants to get to the head of his class and so on, so he cuts out a young fellow out of competition with him. Dishonestly, he violates the ideals of musicians and so forth. Years later, this thing smacks him back in the face again. He's postulated an error someplace in his past that can come back and hit him. The more of those that he plants, the more ideals he is violating, you might say, the more fragile becomes his own survival. Till a whole house of cards can cave in. As he is. He's not building survival. He's building a house of cards. You take a doctor with a great ethical code and so forth that medicine is reputed to have, and who knows, some may have it. You take a doctor who is true to his Hippocratic oath. Oh, I know everybody says it's very nice to be true to his oath, and that's sweet. Did you ever know a doctor who had gone in for criminal practice, for instance? They're pretty bad off. It's pathetic. Look at these people. I knew a fellow one time that was dragging around and met him. He was a bum on a park bench. And he had started into the big money in 1930. He had become a gangster's doctor. A doctor to gangsters. Prohibition. Lots of money. He was going to have himself a big, beautiful home and so forth. He was being untrue to his own code, to the codes of his profession, and so forth. It's a very strange thing. He built high and mighty and heavy, all right, there for about 2 years. And he knew too much about what was going on in gangland. And of course, he couldn't be trusted. He had violated his own primary codes, hadn't he? Then how could anybody else trust him? There's this instinctive feeling about him. And what with everything else, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came along and put an end to prohibition and the big money and gangsterism, and there but for him went a doctor. He was ruined by the violation of his own ideals. Take imagining. The only way you can really postulate any kind of a goal at all is imagination. If you don't postulate high-flown goals, you don't hitch your wagon to a star, it's a cinch you're not going to get up at the top of the pine tree. Because it takes that much to get this much. You know, in Alice in Wonderland, it says they have to run just to keep up. You have to run twice as fast if you want to get anyplace. The basic tone scale has then these factors of life, its urge towards survival, and its necessity to cooperate with other life forms in order to survive, and its decline because it has fallen out of cooperation with other life forms. It postulates, predicts the amount of survival. Actually, with this tone scale, we are actually measuring an energy. We're measuring a wavelength. It's very, very sharply computable, by the way, and it does certain things about certain things. Tomorrow night, I'm going to talk to you more about light energy and outline what seems to be the way it goes about its conquest of the physical universe, why. And also the value of this cycle with growth, decay, so on. I would like to know now if you have any questions with regard to tonight's lecture. Very glad to answer them if you haven't. Possibly some of you have some question regarding some part of survival, something of the sort. No volunteers? You all must be asleep. Okay. Yes?
When the bundle of vectors starts to go down, they all go down together?
It's odd, but they seem to go down in two ways. They seem to go down in two ways. Here's your basic tone scale. And here your... This represents one individual, by the way. He has all these urges. All these urges of life are resonant in one individual. And let's say he's at that level. Now, you must realize that each one of these has an extended sphere and a small sphere. Let's take other people. Let's take the people in this room and the people in Wichita. At first, when this dynamic is high, this would be the third dynamic pertaining to Wichita. When this dynamic is high, here are all the people of Wichita. Fellow feels affinity for all the people of Wichita. As he comes down the tone scale on some of the other dynamics, although nothing has happened between him and the people of Wichita, you will find him only sympathetic with the people in this room. In other words, the scope has closed in on him. And so with each dynamic, the scope closes in on the dynamic, and it foreshortens, and they all seem to do it together. Is there another question?
You mentioned the two individuals low on the tone scale would aid each other in their downfall. Why isn't it that an individual low on the tone scale and an individual high on the tone scale, the lower one wouldn't be raised by the higher one?
Oh, the lower one is, quite ordinarily. As a matter of fact, it is a truism in business that the world is carried upon the backs of a few desperate men. Those would be a few fellows who were high enough up the tone scale and had enough personal volume in order to carry others on their backs. As a matter of fact, as you look around you, you will find out this society is carrying the lame and the halt on every hand and making a tremendous effort. The high tone scales are just trying like the mischief to defeat the low tone scale people. The low tone scale people, if you'll notice, just try like the mischief to defeat the efforts of the high tone scale people, but they still come up the line a little bit. You go down to the hospital down here, And you'll find there's some girl that she doesn't eat well. She has malnutrition. That's what they call it. But it actually is a suicide. She's killing herself off by not eating. She doesn't even figure this out. I mean, that's just the way it's operating. She stops eating and she starts dying. And they can't find nothing organically wrong with her or anything of the sort. And here are all the doctors and the nurses and everybody around giving her intravenous shots and persuading her to eat and doing this and that for her. She doesn't want it. She's on her way out. Now, if the society just took its hands up on the everything from two down, boy, those people would just die off like flies. You would be fascinated how fast they would not stick around. But they are being carried along in the backs of a few desperate, high-tone scale people. Yes?
Is each individual from the factor of each dynamic roughly the same
time? Not necessarily. An individual seems to have his characteristics have to do with being stronger on one dynamic than another, just natively stronger. Here are two individuals, they have more or less the same background. One is very strong on groups, and the other is very, very strong on mankind. And this fellow becomes a nationalist and something of the sort, and this fellow over here becomes an internationalist. It's just the way it rolls. Any further questions? Well, I want to thank you very, very much for your kind attention, and I hope to see you all here tomorrow night at 8:00.